So I'm still a bit filled with what I did the last 4 or 5 days. So it's kind of in the with the kind of continuum, the momentum of these last days that I give this talk. And that is, last Wednesday I went to Spirit Rock Meditation Center for with my 7-year-old son to do Buddhist family camp. To sing Buddhist family camp songs and other things, and it was quite lovely. And Ajahn Amaro, who's a wonderful Theravadan monk, was there teaching the kids other things. And then Betsy Rose was singing, and Reverend Heng Shur, a Chinese, an American ordained in the Chinese Buddhist tradition. Came just briefly to play his guitar and sing, and a lot of wonderful things. And when I went there, days before I went, I remember that that the Buddha had a son. His name was Rahula, and Rahula was ordained to be a novice monk when he was 7 years old. And then there's some teachings that survive of what the Buddha, how the Buddha taught his own son. And there's one tradition that he started teaching in particular teachings when he was 7. So I had in this back of my mind, oh, 7 years old, maybe that's a good time to teach him something. And I thought maybe one of the things I would do is read the discourse where the Buddha is teaching his 7-year-old son, because, you know, kind of thought it'd be kind of work for my 7-year-old. But we didn't get around to it. Somehow I didn't think he was ready. And he did express his interest in becoming a novice monk for a week. He found out during when we were up there that you could do that for a week some places, and. So he thought that was kind of interesting and expressed some interest in doing that. So I wanted to tell you about what the Buddha said to his son. Since I believe you're old enough. It's a little bit hard to understand or to interpret the accounts of that survive of how the Buddha related to his son. And you should be a little bit slow and kind of jumping to kind of conclusions that, you know, the Buddha was a dad living in the suburbs, and, you know, and that's how the context for how to interpret what he did. But in any case, as the story goes, soon after Rahula was born, the Buddha left the family life. He left his household. He left his wife and his newborn child, left the palace, and went off and for about 6 years wandered around India as an ascetic, as a spiritual seeker, as a renunciant. And at the end of those 6 years, he attained his enlightenment. And then for about a year, he taught a little bit around. He wandered around and met people, and as the story goes, he met with quite a bit of success as a teacher. And very quickly, people would come to him and receive his teachings, and some of them got what he had to teach, and some of them became ordained as monks during that first year. And during that first year, he made his way back to his hometown. It's a bit of a journey, but he made it back. And so back to visit, you know, where he came from and his family, his father, his stepmother, his wife was there, and his son. So he finally saw his son again when his son was 7 years old. Now it seems that the wife was a little bit angry. When the Buddha came back to town, she told Rahula, go see him and get your inheritance. And the inheritance of a, what I think what she meant was that the Buddha was supposed to be a prince. His father was kind of like the king, the tribal king, tribal chieftain. And the inheritance, I guess, was to the kingdom, was to kind of pass on that the royal line. That's probably what she meant, but she said send him down to get the inheritance. And so the Buddha apparently was sitting there, and Rahula went up to his father, and Rahula said to his father, "Your shadow is very pleasant." At which point the Buddha got up and walked away. Which, in other situations where the Buddha got up and walked away, it seems to be when people became enamored with him, somehow in awe of him, enamored with him, and it seems to be one of his pedagogical techniques was for them to walk away. And often if they were enamored, they would follow him, and then there'd be more to the story. And it seems that when Rahula said to him, your shadow is pleasant, it might have been a very, we don't know how to interpret that, but it might have been a very formal, polite way of saying something like, it's really pleasant, it's really wonderful to be in your presence. Your aura is great. Being under your shadow is really great. So it's kind of like somehow stating how positive it is to be in the presence of the Buddha. And it was quite something to see at Spirit Rock this last week, how that so many of the children there related to the two monks who were there, Ajahnamurō and Venerable Ahimsako. And they were so attentive. They were kind of, there was something about the monastic form and the presence of these two that really captured the attention of the kids. And my son, kind of became enamored with the junior monk who was there, a young man who was ordained for 10 months, and my son was just kind of like, he was really taken by him. So so maybe something like that happened, and the Buddha, for reasons I don't quite understand, he got up and walked away. And I like to interpret that in a positive way, rather than he was cold and he hadn't seen his son in 7 years. He just got up and walked away. But anyway, so Rahula followed him, and then Rahula said, give me my inheritance. And so the Buddha turns to Shariputra. And Shariputra is kind of like the Buddha's right-hand man. He's like one of his wisest, most senior, important disciples. And he turns to Shariputra and he says, ordain him. So the answer to, the only inheritance that he had to pass on was not the wealth and the royal lineage, but was the Dharma that he had. And so he said, ordain him. And so, with not too much then, very quickly, Rahula was ordained by Shariputra as a novice monk. And probably, Rahula was enamored by the Buddha and somehow was taken by what was there and was kind of willing, went along to be ordained as a novice. And so then the Buddha's father, Shakya, and what's his name? Sudana, came to the Buddha soon thereafterward and said, basically something like, the bonds between a parent and a child are really deep. And the loss of a child is painful right down to the marrow of the bones. And so the Buddha said, okay. And then he instituted a new rule for ordaining people. He said that a person cannot be ordained without getting permission of his or her parents. And so to make sure that the parents were on board and the parents wouldn't be pained in some, in some way that was too painful, too difficult. And in fact, we find stories of people who did not get the permission of their parents, and then the difficulties that caused. So then Rahula became a novice, And it seems that he remained a novice until he was about 19 or 20, at which point he was ordained as a full monk. So he spent, most of his youth in a monastic life. And then you come to a story that's attributed to when Rahula was 11. And this is a very famous story, teaching. It's Tanisara Bhikkhu's seemingly favorite teaching. He refers to this a lot and talks about it. A monk who comes here a lot, he talks. And it's not said explicitly in the story, but it seems that the young novice Rahula had told a lie. So that's not so far-fetched for a young boy, young child, to maybe tell a lie. I didn't do it. Or something like that, right? So Rahula went and sat down next to the Buddha. And the Buddha what happened was Rahula saw the Buddha coming from a distance, and so he made a seat ready, prepared his seat where he could sit down on the ground, and set out water for washing the feet of the Buddha. It's an Indian custom that at that time that you'd wash a guest's feet when they came to your house, or because people went around barefoot or with sandals and they got dirty, and they would wash off the dust. And so the water was set out, and I guess he washed his feet. And then the Buddha sat down, and then Rahula paid his respect. And then the Buddha had left a little bit of water in the pot, the water pot. And the Buddha said to Rahula, "Rahula, do you see this little bit of water left in the water pot?" "Yes," says Rahula. Even so little, Rahula, is the monkhood of those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie." So, like, imagine a few drops of water left. That's all it's worth, the monastic life of someone who tells a deliberate lie. So I imagine that Rahula here now gulps. Uh-oh. And then the Buddha turned that pot with a little bit of water in it upside down, so the water kind of ran, all the little bit of water was left ran out. And he said to Rahula, "Rahula, do you see this water pot turned upside down?" "Yes." "Even so, Rahula, those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie have turned their monasticism, the monkhood, upside down, to let it, all the goodness of it turn, drain away." Then the Buddha turned the water pot up again, upside, and asked the Venerable Rahula, "Rahula, do you see this hollow, empty water vessel?" Maybe he kind of said it more like, "Rahula, do you see this hollow, empty water vessel?" And then I imagine the Rahula kind of, "Yes." "Yes. Even so hollow and empty is the monkhood of those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie." So it seems like he was being admonished. So then the Buddha teaches a little bit, and one of the things he does is he teaches the following. He says, "Rahula, what is the purpose of a mirror? For the purpose of reflection, Venerable Sir. So too, Rahula, An action with a body should be done after repeated reflection. An action of speech should be done after repeated reflection. An action by mind should be done after repeated reflection. So you should, before, during, and after you do something, by body, well, I didn't say that yet, but by when you do something by your body, by your words, or even in your mind, you should not do it until you've reflected about it for a while, thought about it. Is this a wise thing to do? Is this an appropriate thing to do? There should be some power of reflection, of consideration, that's cultivated and developed. Rahula, when you wish to do an action with the body, you should reflect upon the same bodily action thus. Would this action that I wish to do with the body lead to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both? Is it an unwholesome bodily action with painful consequences, with painful results? When you reflect, if you know this action that I wish to do with the body would lead to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both, it is an unwholesome bodily action with painful consequences, with painful results, then you should not do such an action with the body. But when you reflect the opposite, that this does not lead to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both, when you realize that it is a wholesome bodily action with pleasant consequences and pleasant results, then you may do such an action with the body. So this is how to be a mirror, how to reflect. You see, this is what I'm about to do. Does it cause harm to anybody? And it's what's interesting here is that it's both self and others, and both. It isn't only consider the impact on others, or don't only look at the impact on yourself, but include everyone. Take the big picture in. And what you're doing, is this going to harm yourself or others? There's a tremendous emphasis in Buddhism on living a life of harmlessness, of not causing harm. And I talked to someone this week who is a Dharma practitioner, a very serious practitioner, and she has a very trying time with her mother, very difficult history with her mother. And her mother now is quite elderly and frail and maybe on the last legs of her life, but she remains as difficult as ever, maybe more so. And but now, this friend of mine is the primary caretaker. For many years, he kind of stayed more or less out of the way, out of shooting range. But now she's within shooting range of her mom because she's taking care of her. And her mother was very difficult. And it was just a very particular situation. And so she relied on her practice to stay equanimous and not to kind of lash out or be difficult. And what she dedicated herself to doing, besides just being, trying to stay, present, mindful, equanimous, she dedicated herself to be as harmless as she could. And so she went into the kitchen, and she was very careful to recycle all the plastic I forget all things she said, but like compost the food. And so her idea of harmlessness was not just simply being harmless towards her mother, but she was going to try to live that time in her life as dedicated to being harmless as she could. And that was her refuge in this great difficulty with her mother. I thought that was quite beautiful. Anyway, so reflect on does it cause harm, and what are the consequences for doing what you're going to do? Does it cause harm immediately to self or other? Or what are the consequences down the line? Is it going to cause harm in the future? Then Buddha went on and said, Rahula, while you are doing an action with a body, so first he says, before you do it. Now he says, while you do it. So while you're doing it, you should also reflect. You should reflect the same way. Is the action I'm doing now, I'm engaged in, is it causing harm to myself, to others, or to both? Is it unwholesome or is it wholesome? If you find that it's harmful, then the Buddha said, stop doing it. If you're in the process of doing it, then stop while you're doing it. Then he goes on to say, once you've done something, you should also reflect, having finished doing it, you should then reflect also, did this cause harm to myself, to others, or to both? is this wholesome or is this unwholesome? And if you find that it was harmful to others, that it was unwholesome, this is interesting, then you should confess such a bodily action, reveal it, and lay it open to the teacher or to your wise companions in the holy life. Having confessed it, revealed it, and laid it open, you should undertake restraint for the future. So here, you know, Rahula probably told a lie. So he's being told, you should, even having done it, you should still use the analogy of a mirror and reflect on what you've done. And if you feel you've done something harmful, unwholesome, it's not enough just to kind of in your own mind kind of realize that and let it go, or you can say, I'll just try to do better later. What the Buddha is encouraging Rahula, who's living a monastic life, living with other monks, saying, you should go find one of your good companions, one of your good friends in the monastic life, and you should actually talk about what you did. Lay it open. And something happens. I know the word confession is kind of a charged one for people, sometimes here in the West, especially if they come from certain religious traditions. But there's something very powerful about vocalized stating out loud to someone what you've done. Kind of this public, not public, but acknowledgement, a clear recognition. Saying something out loud to someone else acknowledges our intention around it, acknowledges the reality of it in a much more powerful way than just keeping it to ourselves and saying, well, I hope no one noticed and I'll try to do better later. If you really want to become free of something, a bad habit or something that you do which is not that is harmful, if you really want to try to stop doing that again in the future, one of the very powerful things to do is to actually find someone and you can tell them what you did. This is what I did. And let me bear it open to you. And in that stating it to someone else, may that help me be more restrained in the future around it. So then the Buddha goes on, and this is kind of a long way, and goes through the same thing with speech. Before you speak, while you speak, and after you've spoken, you should reflect on the same way. And then also with the mind. Before you have mental activity, while you have mental activity, and after you have mental activity, there should be some reflection going on, some consideration. Is this harmful, unharmful, skillful, unskillful activity? So it goes on that way, and at the end it says, Rahula was satisfied and delighted in the Buddha's words. Maybe so. Then there's a few other places. It seems that the Rahula spent a lot of time with his father, around his father. After he was, they were both ordained, kind of in the spiritual life. And so even though the Buddha was not present for him the first 7 years, it seemed like there was a lot of contact afterwards. And one of the indications of this is another discourse that's called called the Rahula Sutta. And the Buddha asks Rahula, do you not despise the wise man by constantly living with him? Is the holder of the torch for humanity honored by you? So is it something like, do you not despise the wise person, or what the wise person that you constantly live with? And it's kind of, I don't know if he's testing his son, or I don't know quite what's going on here. But one interpretation is that, the Buddha encouraged you not to judge a teacher quickly, but to hang out with a teacher for a long time, to kind of see the ins and outs of them and kind of test them, find out whether they're really living an ethical life, that they're really living what they say and things like that. And so here at Rahula, I spent a long time living with the Buddha, watching him and all that. And sometimes when you live for a long time with someone, you kind of know their ins and outs, you know their kind of, the way they're kind of crotchety, you know, and kind of, you know, out of the public eye, but kind of, you know, in your family and, you know, they pick their nose or something. And so maybe he's asking, you know, you've been around me for a long time, and have you found any reason to fault me or to be critical of me or despise me? And Rahula then says, no, I do not despise the wise person by constantly living with him. The holder of the torch of humanity is always honored by me. So he's saying he respects it. So that's one interpretation. I kind of imagine that Rahula is a young teenager in this little exchange. And I know my father thought I was angry with him when I was a teenager. And I found out when I was in my 20s that he thought that. And I had no idea that he thought that. I wasn't angry with him, I was just oblivious of him. You know, I was busy. And then there's another story. There's two more stories. It's okay to tell you stories like this? Rahula, ancient stories. Again, the context for this is not given in the original, but the tradition, the commentary tradition, puts the context in this way, that the Buddha and Rahula were going off on alms rounds. And Rahula, as they were setting off on their alms, getting ready for alms, started thinking, reflecting. Something like, two possibilities I've heard as explained. One is that the Buddha apparently was had quite a stunning, beautiful presence. And not only because he, you know, had his enlightenment, but also because he apparently, even before he was enlightened, he had quite a dignified royal presence that caused people to notice him. And Rahula, being related to him, has had some of his looks. And so he was kind of going to follow in the alms in the footsteps of the Buddha, kind of a little bit proud of his own looks. That's one version of the story. The other version of the story is that it was prophesized that the Buddha had two career choices, two avenues open to him as he grew up. One was that he was going to become a monk. And the other was that he was going to become a great monarch, great ruler of India. And he chose to be a monk rather than the great ruler. And so Rahula was thinking, you know, if my dad had become a ruler instead, you know, where would I be then? Now, I wouldn't be out there begging for my food. You know, he had thoughts like that. So somehow the Buddha understood what was on Rahula's mind. And so with that as a context, then the Buddha looked back. So here they're beginning to walk down the road to do their alms. And the Buddha looks back at him. And he says to him, Rahula, any kind of material form, any kind of physical form, whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, coarse or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all physical form should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. So here Rahula is thinking about the beauty and who he, you know, the form and who he would be, his status and all these things. And the Buddha says, you know, whatever physical appearance, whatever physical form a person has should be reflected on in the following way. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. And so this is a very important teaching of the Buddha, you know, not to take things too personally, not to see it as myself. At Spirit Rock, Betsy Rose sang kind of this beautiful song. It was turned into a song by, what's his name? Who wrote The Prophet? What's his name? Yeah. And he has a chapter on children. And it starts off by saying, your children are not your children. So beautiful. I guess it was an a cappella group. What's it called? Sweet... Sweet Honey in the Rock, right, put it to song, and Betsy Rose got it from them. And it's really moving. Your children are not your children. So that's quite a powerful thing to think about. And I think about that a lot. When my son and my children, who I'm responsible in some ways, and they're very you know, some kind of strong connection there. Are they really mine? You know, as my son starts developing in ways that are not necessarily what I would have chosen for him, what is that about? And what's that what relationship do I have to those, that growth and that development, those changes? You know, is he mine to shape? No. So here the Buddha says, even yourself in some way, whatever form or shape that you have, is not self, is not yours, is not I. So this is a very, very deep teaching in Buddhism. I'm not going to try to kind of convey it right now to you. But it points, this teaching about not taking things personally, identifying with them, seeing them as something you possess, is one of the very deep insights that can come with realization. It's one of the insights that leads to realization or liberation or freedom. So the Buddha turns around, and probably in the context of going on an alms round, it was probably unusual for the Buddha to speak during that time. And so to turn around and actually tell this to the Buddha, to Rahula, just as he was thinking about this, you know, these thoughts, you know, kind of got his attention. And, you know, and Rahula then, you know, asked a question in return. He said, is this only true for physical shapes, physical form, physical appearances? And the Buddha said, no. This is also true for your feelings, for your perceptions, for your internal mental activities, and for your consciousness. All of that should be seen as not mine, this I am not, and this is not myself. Then Rahula thought, who would go to town for alms today when personally admonished by the Buddha? So he turned back and sat down at the root of a tree, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness in front of him. So he felt admonished, and being admonished, he just didn't have the heart to go out and get his food for the day. So basically, the day became a fasting day for him, and he went back to meditate. While he was meditating, Shariputra saw him sitting there and asked, what's going on? And he explained. And then later in the day, the Buddha came back, and the Buddha gave him some further teachings. And the Buddha said this to him, to Rahula. Develop meditation. Somewhere else I've seen it. Develop the mind. Develop the mind or develop your meditation. Develop meditation that is like the earth. For when you develop meditation that is like the earth, agreeable and disagreeable things will not invade your mind and remain there. Just as people throw clean things and dirty things, excrement, urine, spittle, pus, and blood on the earth, and the earth is not repelled, humiliated, and disgusted because of that, so too, Rahula, develop meditation that is like the earth. For when you develop meditation that is like the earth, things that are agreeable or disagreeable will not invade your mind and stick there. You don't get hung up on them. So develop them. Sometimes if you talk about meditation, you know, sit there as if you're a mountain. That's the one image people use. Or imagine yourself like a still, you know, mountain lake. The mind is like a still mountain lake. And here he's saying, when you meditate, imagine yourself like the earth, you know, big, large, unfazed by what happens to it. And then he gives him this following image. Develop meditation that is like water. For when you develop meditation that is like water, agreeable and disagreeable things will not invade your mind and stick there. Just as people wash clean things and dirty things, in the water is not repelled, humiliated, and disgusted because of that. So too, develop a mind and meditation that is like water. Rahula, develop meditation that is like fire. For when you develop meditation that is like fire, agreeable and disagreeable things will not invade your mind and remain there. Just as people burn clean and dirty things in a fire, and the fire is not repelled, and so forth, so when you develop this meditation, agreeable and disagreeable things will not invade and stick in your mind. Develop your meditation like air. For when you develop meditation is like the air, same thing, repeats itself. Develop your meditation like space. I remember, so same thing around space. Remember Suzuki Roshi, I think it was, who said, space is untroubled by your presence. Whether you're tall or short or large or teeny or whatever you are, I mean, space just accommodates you. It's not untroubled. So develop a mind like space. They often in Buddhism, they also often have the image of letting your thoughts pass through your mind like a cloud drifting through the sky. The sky is not troubled by the clouds. It just holds the clouds and the clouds go by. So the same thing with your thoughts, just let them drift through. Let your mind be like a sky, like space. And then he goes on and says, encourages the Rahula to develop meditation on loving kindness. For when you develop meditation on loving kindness, ill will be abandoned. You'll lose your ill will. Develop meditation on compassion, for then cruelty will be abandoned. Develop meditation on appreciative joy, for then discontent will be abandoned. Develop meditation on equanimity, for then aversion will be abandoned. And he goes through and he gives him a variety of different meditations, and he ends with giving him meditation on mindfulness of breathing. So he's giving his son a variety of tools to use in different situations, a variety of images of how to meditate, kind of giving some hint on how to, kind of presence you need to have in meditation to develop this kind of equanimous presence that can allow things to arise and not be troubled by it, good and bad things, you're not going to react to it. And then it said, Rahula was satisfied and delighted by the Buddha's words. It's very nice, right? So then there's one more story that's told in the sutras around Rahula. So when Rahula was about 19 or 20, he became ordained as a monk. That's the rule in Buddhism. You can't be a full monk until you reach about 19 or 20. And at some point, the Buddha understood that his son was now ready to receive the deepest teachings he had to offer. His mind was kind of ripe. He'd been training now for how long? 13 years or so? And in the monastic life. So I taught this maybe here a few weeks ago, a few months ago, but this particular story. But then the Buddha said, come with me. And the Buddha took Rahula deep into the woods to a place that was called Blind Man's Grove. And they were already living in the woods, kind of at the edge of town. But he took his son deeper into the woods, in a place where there were these sal trees, which are very huge, huge, majestic trees with big, kind of these tapering kind of trunks that form these roots. You can sit in the crevice of the roots. And it's a grove of these trees, and I imagine it was quite majestic, very still, quite beautiful. Maybe some of you have been, went up, sat in some of the great redwood groves by yourself and felt the presence of those trees and what it's like to be a person, a human being, in the presence of these huge, huge, majestic sequoia trees and the stillness there. And it kind of puts your life into a little different context when you think, oh, this tree has been here for 1,000 years or 2,000 years or however long. So he took his son to such a place. And then he taught the Buddha, he taught Rahula something similar they taught him earlier. He taught him the teachings on not self. Taught his son how not to identify or get attached or use as a reference for self his body, his appearances, his feelings, his perceptions, his thoughts, mental activities, his intentions, his dispositions, his personality, or his consciousness. The whole kind of psychophysical package of who we are. He taught his son, don't attach to any of this as this is who I really am. And by this time, after 13 years as a novice monk, he was kind of ready for that, to hear that. Because when you stop doing that, and if you really can learn to let go of the tendency to identify, to personally, take things personally, to hold on to things as this is who I am, then the mind begins to release itself, the heart begins to release. Because the identification with things, with something as a self, comes as a form of grasping, holding. And when there's no holding, no reference like that, then the mind kind of becomes free like space, just open. Things rise, they pass, but there's no kind of holding on to it or categorizing it or fixing it or trying to make it permanent this way. This is who I really am. And there's something about that realization of not self, of releasing the mind from that tendency to grip onto self, which opens a door to a phenomenal peace, to great peace. Some people would say it's kind of like our birthright, the inheritance that Ruhula was supposed to get, was that peace that the Buddha had tasted for himself. And now he was passing that peace on, in a sense, to his son. And I can't think of a better thing to pass on to your children. The kind of very wonderful happiness and peace that comes with deep spiritual practice. I know a lot of parents who will say something like, you know, what I really want for my children is for them to be happy. And it doesn't really matter what they do in their lives so much, but that they find their happiness. And the Buddha was able to touch a certain depth of happiness that is not the kind of conventional happiness of, you know, success in your career or things like that. And the mind's capacity to be at peace with itself, not without any conflict with itself or with the world around, with the mind in a sense, come to rest, settled on itself. So that's what was on my mind this last week, and wondering about my son, and wondering if and when and how, you know, I could take him into the woods and then tell him something. But this week I contented myself that it wasn't the time for me to do it, but he did tell me that he was interested in becoming a novice monk for a week. So maybe one of these years, the two of us will go to a monastery and maybe get ordained together for a week. See what that's like. So I hope that was okay to give that talk, and thank you very much for the evening.